Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, we visit with Daniel Leonard, Ag Agent in Calhoun County, Florida, and NACAA Vice Chair for Communications Programs. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Good morning, Jay.
Good morning, sir.
How are you?
Doing well.
That's a different voice.
Folks
haven't heard that one before.
Nope.
We have the good opportunity to be in Des Moines, Iowa this week at the National Ag Agents Association Conference. It's held every year, and it's moved around different parts of the country. David and Vicki rode up over the weekend. I came up a day later, and for the most part, had a pretty uneventful drive. Mm-hmm. I drove through quite a bit of rain to get here, but rains in August are not a bad thing.
We skirted skirted it coming up here on Saturday and the day we came up. But anyway, we had a good drive and enjoyed seeing some of the country that we don't normally get to see. And it looks a lot like ours, but just a lot more of it, a lot more corn, a lot more soybeans, that kind of thing. So
yeah, I came up just a slightly different from you. I came a little farther west into Missouri before I headed north, but we paralleled each other. And most of the crops that I drove through looked pretty good. There was a couple of spots where you could tell the dry weather had affected them a little earlier in the year, but not terrible. Didn't look too bad.
So. We saw some corn. I guess it was actually still in Missouri on our ride up. And
northeastern part.
We're not exactly sure. We've been investigating to see what the problem was, but it definitely is something's going
spot.
On. We think it's tar spot. Yeah.
We hope we don't get that.
Yeah.
Just like I say, a little west of y'all, I come up right almost through the middle of north central Missouri to get into Iowa. And there was just a couple of places into Iowa that looked a little dry, but for the most part, everything that I saw, especially beans right now, looks wonderful.
Yep.
It was a beautiful drive, and I noticed we had talked about it. Actually, David and I did on the way up, the many silos. Almost every farm, had a silo. And
feed lots of cattle up there.
Yeah, that's right.
Not much of that's happening right now,
Well, and that's probably the biggest difference between the area y'all drove through and where I was slightly west. In that part of northern Missouri, there's more corn now than there was 10 years ago when I used to spend a lot of time in that part of the state. Heavy livestock area. And there was one little town there, Green City, Missouri, that I drove through, had a mural painted on the side of one of their old buildings that says, "This is cattle country." And it driving through there. A lot of livestock comes out of that part of the world. And
absolutely.
We're glad of it, thankful for it.
Yeah, for sure.
Got a guest with us today, Mr. Daniel Leonard. Good morning again, sir.
Good morning again.
Hello again.
Happy to be here.
Glad to have you. We appreciate you. Vicki reached out to you last week and said you asked if you wanted to do this with us, and we appreciate you sitting down and helping us learn a little bit about Florida agriculture and some of your NACAA responsibilities.
Yes, sir. Always happy to do a favor for Vicki.
To start off with, why don't you just tell a little bit about yourself, where you're from in Florida, and where you work?
Sure. So, my name's Daniel Leonard. I'm the County Extension Director and Ag Agent in Calhoun County, Florida. We're not the part of Florida that you think of when you think of Florida. So we're in the panhandle, my part of the state called Lower Alabama. We're about an hour west of Tallahassee, a small county. We've only got about 15,000 people in the whole county, so it's pretty small. Probably similar to some rural Kentucky areas.
Mm-hmm. Very similar.
A lot of farms, a lot of cattle, a lot of forests. So it's a great place to live. I'm actually a fifth generation in Calhoun County, so we've been there since about 1900. So
that's cool.
Kind of unusual for the state of Florida, too. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was thinking yesterday after we had chatted there a little bit at the welcoming dinner last night when you walked off, I thought, well, I didn't even ask if he was from Florida.
Yep.
I wondered that because I've never asked you that, but like you said, a lot of times not a lot of people move to Florida.
We're a state of transplants, that's for sure. A lot of people want to come to Florida, but we've been there a long time.
I used to work with Guy and good friends with some folks in LA and Lower
that's
Alabama.
Right. That's
you're probably familiar with Andalusia and
some
of those places.
Yep.
So, The guy used to have a house outside of Tallahassee.
Okay.
My parents used to go down and visit them and spend a little time there.
He's got connections everywhere.
Oh, you don't even know. Yeah. You don't even know.
Yeah. You just don't know.
Anywhere we go, if anybody mentions a little city or just anything.
He's been there.
He's been there.
Know where it's at.
And he starts to tell you everything around it and the places to eat. And, you know, he's
well-traveled.
He's well-traveled.
Well-traveled, that's well-traveled. Right.
We at one time had a state specialist that was from Andalusia, too.
Really?
Dr. Benji Michael. That's the town that he was from.
So.
Okay.
Yeah. He was in the meats lab, right?
Yeah.
He was.
Yeah.
He was.
Meat specialist.
County seat of Covington County, Alabama. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. There you go.
Exactly.
So cool. I went to school over that way in Pensacola. So I went to University of Florida, has a research and education center in Milton and Jay, West Florida. And so that's where I did my undergrad. So I spent
neat.
Some time in West Florida over there.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat.
Good places to be. So tell us just a little bit about Calhoun County and the agriculture there and a little bit about your extension programs.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Calhoun County is very similar to a lot of the counties surrounding us in the Panhandle. Once you get off the coast, of course, we don't have a coastline in Calhoun County. One of the reasons we're small and fairly poor as it goes. So Calhoun County, our primary ag crop is going to be timber. We have about 300,000 acres of pine trees in production. That's come down a little bit since Hurricane Michael in 2018 blew all the trees down. Mm-hmm. But that's mostly been replanted. We grow a lot of cotton and peanuts. Those are by far our two biggest agronomic crops. A little bit of beans. Our bean acres are not big, maybe 3,000 or 4,000 acres a year. So it's minor. But cattle's big in the area. That's risen a lot recently. Deseret Cattle and Timber, the Latter-day Saints Church agronomic arm, has moved there. We're about 300,000 acres, 60,000 of it's in the county. Mm-hmm. And so brought a lot of cattle to the county, too. So that was former pine tree land after the hurricane cleared up. Now it's in pasture. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting place to be agriculturally, for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And tell our listeners that may not be familiar with peanuts and cotton.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, maybe the growing season and how some of that happens and what they do as far as harvest goes and that kind of thing.
Yep. So peanuts, a unique crop. It grows in the ground. You'd be surprised the amount of people that want to see the peanut tree, you know.
Right.
Peanuts, definitely an under-the-ground crop. We grow about 10,000 acres of peanuts in Calhoun County every year. Peanuts, 135, 140-day crop. We plant them typically late April into the 1st of June in there, and they're harvested coming up anywhere middle of September through about the 1st of November. It's a unique crop. It grows low to the ground, only about, you know, 18 inches, 24 inches tall. Most of the growth as far as, you know, reproductive growth, nuts mm-hmm. under the ground. So it's a pretty little crop. It's kind of a green carpet out there, kind of a Kelly green. It's one of our prettier crops.
Oh, I don't know that I've ever even seen it growing.
You've never seen a peanut field?
Yeah.
Oh, it's my goodness.
Yeah, I don't know that I have.
Yep. And so in the fall, they'll run their inverters, you know, throw the peanuts under the ground onto the top of the ground, let them dry.
There's some good YouTube videos.
There. Yeah.
That's where you can go and look at those.
It's peanut digging's entertaining for sure. Yeah. But typically that time of the year we're dry, you know, where it's always kind of a gamble. Once you invert those peanuts and get them on top of the ground, we want them to stay dry. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want them to get wet. A lot of times those times of the year we'll get a late tropical storm or something to come in that mm-hmm. causes problems. But long as we're dry, once they get up out of the ground, we're good to go on that.
How long do they have to stay up on top of the ground to dry like that
Just about a week normally. Yeah. A little less than a week sometimes.
You speak of tropical storms, and David will know exactly where I'm going with this. We hate to see any of those ever hit the coast.
Right.
But on that same hand, the rains that they provide, we grow a lot of double crop soybeans behind wheat in our area, especially in the county that David and I both live in. About close to 60,000 acres of double crop wheat and beans. And there's been a lot of years that those tropical storm rains end up making our bean crop.
Yeah.
Especially in a dry year.
Yep. David and I talked about that a little bit yesterday. Yeah.
Yep.
That's interesting. Yeah, we don't like them on the coast there. Sometimes we get a little too much rain and definitely a little too much wind from time to time. But I'm glad that they're a blessing to y'all when they get there. So.
not much of one when they're down there with y'all.
A little bit less of a blessing for us, that's for sure.
Sure.
And like Jay said, though, some years it has saved crops.
Yeah, no doubt.
It really has. Yeah. And
Tennessee, Kentucky, up there. Yes. That area. Mm-hmm. It really has.
Yeah, more years than not, it has saved. Mm-hmm. It has saved some crops for us.
We're kind of the opposite. We almost never lose a crop year to drought, but we can definitely lose crop years to too much rain. And that's mm-hmm. typically we're kind of the opposite there. We, you know, in Calhoun County, we're going to average about 65 to 80 inches of rain a year. And last couple of years with those storms, we've been mm-hmm. up around 100. You know, and yeah. that's a little more than we need.
So. Right.
Yeah,
right.
And when you get those large rains.
It makes things difficult.
Yeah, you can lose a crop pretty.
You can
pretty and quickly, I would think.
Calhoun County's geography doesn't, or topography, I guess, doesn't help. We're pretty flat. Mm-hmm. We're on the coastal plain there. We're about 60 miles inland from the coast, so it's flat and there's not a lot of places for the water to go. So when we get right. those yeah. intense rainfalls, it can hang around for a while and cause yeah. some issues.
Real yeah. sandy kind of soil, I'm assuming, or fair, no?
Compared to Kentucky, for sure. compared yeah. to the beach, we've got a little bit better yes. soil. You know, yeah. we can grow crops and things. We're about sure. as far south as you can go. The south end of Calhoun County is about as far south towards the Gulf you can go and still grow a row crop. So we've
okay.
got a little bit of clay. You know, we reach mm-hmm. up towards the Georgia and Alabama border, and it's a little yeah. bit better in the northern part of the county for sure.
Yeah. I know you have horticulture responsibilities as well.
I do.
Any commercial hort much there in that county?
We actually have one large grower of indoor floriculture, so you know, mostly tropical foliage. They've expanded a little bit into annuals and mostly perennials, ornamental grasses, but Florida is the number one producer of tropical foliage in the country, mm-hmm. so it's big industry, and that producer, Oglesby Plants, I actually worked at when I was going to community college there in Marianna, so
yeah,
that was my cool. part-time job coming up. Actually, it was my first experience in horticulture. I grew mm-hmm. up on a farm, but that was my first sort of commercial experience in ag and really got me interested into horticulture. And my undergraduate degree was in plant science with a focus on environmental hort. So,
yeah.
Started that's in that field and then transitioned to ag a little bit later.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Oglesby's definitely one of the largest private employers in the county. So
I think that's the beauty of agriculture and careers in agriculture, but in just even in college and the classes that you take, it is so vast and diverse.
It is.
It really is, and you can go in so many different directions in agriculture, and it kind of depending on what your interests are and what job of availability is, and then of course in extension, it gives you the opportunity to really work with all those aspects of agriculture that's in your county and the connecting counties. I'm sure Florida's like us. If you have a vacancy in the next county over, you're probably having to help a little bit over there as well. And
absolutely.
And I think that's what makes careers in extension enjoyable. And it's because you can work with different. You're not just. I know when, as a crop consultant, when I graduated college, you know, I was working for a farm retail store, mm-hmm. and I was a crop consultant, and I worked with corn, soybeans, and wheat.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. You know, I didn't work with livestock. Really, didn't work with any forages or anything of that nature. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, and so I think that's and every state has their different crops, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah, I do love how diverse extension mm-hmm. is, especially at a small county like we are. I'm the only we have a 4-H agent, but as far as the ag and horticulture goes, I'm it. So I get yep. to do a little mm-hmm. bit of everything, from helping folks with their lawn grass all the way to you know, scouting a peanut field. So it's a fascinating career, that's for sure.
I did that a big part of my career in the two counties I was in yeah. before, and then one of those counties ultimately hired a horticulture agent,
yeah.
and it was needed. We had at the time about 20,000 acres of commercial horticulture
wow.
in two counties, mm-hmm. big Amish and Mennonite population.
Yeah, sure.
And that it oftentimes is a position in and of itself.
I mean, it is.
Folks mm-hmm. can get as deeply involved in that as
exactly
they really
right.
care to.
Yeah, probably half my time spent, you know, with residential horticulture, just walk-ins, yeah. you know, helping win their landscapes. And that's, yeah. I love to do that. That's how I got my start in ag. I worked, like I said, at Oglesby. And then my first job out of college was at a large in-ground shade tree nursery, Panhandle Growers over in mm-hmm. West Florida. You know, we grew mostly live oaks and crepe myrtles. Those were and magnolias, our three mm-hmm. primary crops, in ground in some larger containers. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
that's cool.
That's a cool way to start.
Yeah.
yeah.
But Reddit got the opportunity to move closer to home, and then actually moved back home to my home county in Calhoun County when the longtime agent retired. You know how that goes.
That's exactly how I started.
Same career extension. Path there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
David did that once.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Yeah. David's dad was actually the ag agent in his home county for a lot of years.
Yeah. 27.
There was somebody there between them, but he had a chance to follow behind and work.
That's
there.
That's pretty cool. So,
yeah.
It was really neat. Yeah, and then I thought the grass was greener, and then went off and did something else a minute and came back and had to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
But, you know, extension is a calling. And I tell people that all the time. You kind of got a servant's heart, but you got to really want to help people.
You do.
And, you know, I missed it, you know, and I really enjoyed doing it. And so I finally came back and I really enjoy where I'm at now and have a great group to work with. So, you know, and I know we all do. And that's the good thing about extension. A lot of times, the majority of the time, you have really good people to work with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I once heard an ag agent who's long since retired now make a similar statement to that. He was on the push in our state association to get more benefits, get some benefits increased from the university. And he made the statement to some of our administrators. He said, you know, to do this job, he said, you have to have a missionary's zeal.
Mm-hmm.
To really perform
that's
it,
right.
He said.
Right.
But none of us took a vow of poverty.
that's exactly. We still got to live, you know. Yeah. But we work closely, like I said, work closely with Georgia and Alabama, University of Auburn, Auburn University and University of Georgia. One of our Georgia specialists, Dr. Bob Kimmerade, often says extension is the best job there is. So
I agree
with that. So
I do too. I agree with it, and like I said, not only because of the diversity and no 2 days are alike, but like David said, that, you know, helping people. I mean, when you can help somebody, and it doesn't matter to what extent you're helping them, but if you're helping somebody, that's just, you know, when we get to do that every day, that's the priority of our jobs. That just makes it a lot more enjoyable than having a sales quota you're going to have to meet or, you know, and I think, in careers, if you're ever thinking about going into extension as a career, our listeners, the thing that you got to remember is we have to meet people where they are, and you have to be able to connect to people. You have to be able to build those relationships with people. And it isn't a job that you go in at 8 o'clock and you're going to leave it at 4:30. That's not extension. There's going to be a lot of days that happens, but there's a lot of days that's not the way it is either. But
you know,
it's still the best job to me in the world.
I agree.
The other thing I like about extension, we actually work with the University of Georgia Poultry Science Department.
Yep.
And one of the poultry specialists actually comes to my county and we do farm visits.
Okay.
And he does a program for me. And, you know, I'm almost positive that if I had somebody that was wanting to raise peanuts that I could call Daniel.
Right.
And I mean, really, that's a good thing about extension. Yeah. I feel like I could call him and he could, you know, he would get back with me and talk about, you know, tell me what I needed to know about growing peanuts.
Yeah.
I mean,
I
think everybody's like that.
I think that's exactly right. You know, Kentucky and Tennessee Extension Services shared specialists for a while in the tobacco. They both still needed a tobacco specialist, but they didn't need one each.
Right.
So we started sharing a lot of our resources and kindly formed a working group of specialists between the two states, which really has benefited both states.
It is. And like y'all mentioned, you know, you share farmers, and when you're close to the border like we are, we share farmers with other states. You know, farming's a big business, and there's definitely land rented by Georgia and Alabama farmers in our area, too. So we're happy to cross state lines and help any way we can.
Oh, absolutely. And Daniel, I know you help and work with the Communications Award Program here with the NACAA. Kind of tell us a little bit about that and kind of, you know, how you got involved in that.
Yeah, so I do love the communications program and the awards program in NACAA. And so what we do is just basically we're recognizing the good work that us as extension agents are. I can't, since I'm in the committee, I can't get my work recognized, but that's all right. Just recognize work that extension agents in our association do. And so in the communications program, we're thinking any kind of written, oral, communications, marketing, you know, it could be from a personal column. It could be something like we're doing today, a podcast. There's an audio recording category, video recording category. It's just really rewarding getting to look through what everybody's done throughout the Southern region, which is very large. We're by far the biggest region with it's not necessarily landmass, but certainly with membership. And so we encompass everywhere from, you know, Florida to Kentucky, west to Oklahoma and Texas, you know, so it's a big area. And so, it's a fun job. It's a big job, as Vicky knows. Vicky's the Kentucky region chair, and David's being modest. He's got a long history of some excellent submissions. So.
It's a group effort.
It is. And you do get to see, to me, communications is a great way to learn. Because you get to see the work that people other places are doing. I've gotten a lot of ideas from judging communication awards, to be honest with you. So if you see some of my programs, they're probably somewhat based off of something somebody else did somewhere else.
But that's the beauty of Extension, too, because we will share anything we have.
Right.
Yeah. Once it's created, you know, we'll share it with anybody. Sure. I think that's just another benefit.
If it works.
Yeah.
You know, it's helpful when it works. But even if it doesn't work, you can go, well, hey, I tried this and this didn't work for me.
But it may work for you.
But it may work for you or may not, you know, and you can decide whether that might be something you'd be interested in.
Yeah. Almost all of those national winning communication awards probably have a story like that, where they started with something and kind of honed their craft as they went. And by the time they were a national winner, they kind of got it in there where they needed to be.
Right. You know, I've helped judge some other areas, other award areas outside of communications, and you see the similarities from all of those all of those winners. That it seems like and that's not to say that we don't have a lot of innovative programs from early career agents, but you do see some of that kindly roll over from area to area to area, that where those folks have been working a lot of years and they've really fine tuned what they're doing.
Exactly.
And it's not just the program and the program delivery. Those folks, I feel like, through their years of experience, have learned their clientele.
They have.
And they learn how to mine what their clientele needs. Sometimes our clients aren't real forthcoming with things that they need, but they've learned how to mine that out of them and read between the lines and see what groups really need. And I think that's a big thing, takeaway thing, that anybody can learn from.
Absolutely. And, you know, communications, you think it's just a beauty contest. You know, it's judging a flyer or a video, but really getting back to what you said, a lot of times the tiebreaker, you know, everybody's stuff looks good nowadays. You know, everybody can be a graphic designer. It's pretty simple with the different programs and all. And everybody can put on a podcast and to some extent. Maybe not David, but most people do a pretty good job with it. But really where we can differentiate and pick truly the best of the best are those impacts, you know, where we can tell in those applications where what this person is submitting actually made a difference to their clientele.
Yeah. Some of those awards that I've judged, you ask the question, it's a great program.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful flyer.
Right.
Did it meet the needs of the clientele?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our old district director who just retired, Dr. Pete Vergott, always said, so what? That was his famous catchphrase.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, we did this program, so what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's interesting.
And that is. But, you know, it takes a while. I can remember. I've been an agent for 22 years. And I can remember those first few years. You can read all about the impact and long-term impact and you know, what good did you do with that program. But it's still hard to kind of grasp that. And then all of a sudden it just kind of clicks. You know, like 4 or 5 years in, it just kind of clicks and you're like, oh, now I know what I understand what they were saying now, because it does kind of come together like that.
It does.
I think it's when it does, it makes it a whole lot, it just, even planning the programs, you know
and the good thing about these programs is that you can get a group of people you have somebody that's not good at graphic design like myself, and you can team up with somebody that is, and, you know, everybody's got their strengths, and, you know, and being able to bring all of that together, that's really kind of neat. You
absolutely.
Know, to be able to, and to have an award program that you can do, that you can enter some of those materials in is really unique to me in today's world, for sure.
Well, as the state chair for communication, and I've been there, I don't know, 12, 13 years, I guess, and I, you know, every year I say, my gosh, there's some phenomenal work that's going on in Kentucky that you might, because, you know,
you wouldn't know it if you weren't.
Yeah, I would not know that because you know, it may be across the state a program that they're doing or you know, something that they've put together. That you're right, David. I would not know it if I wasn't, you know, there and being able to look at newsletters and how folks put their newsletters together and you know. But it also reminds me though of how much time that agents put in to putting this stuff together, And that shows right there the pride that they have in the job that they're doing. Not because they want a pat on the back, but because they want to do quality work mm-hmm. for the people that they serve.
That's right.
And you can see that. And you see it much more than I do, Daniel, because you see such a larger area than I do. Yeah. But I know you see that same thing. You can tell, you know, that they take pride in what they do.
Absolutely. These people care about it across these 13 states in the southern region, that's for sure. So what got you into communications? What's your niche in communications, Vicki?
Well, honestly, I just said yes,
That's what I was guessing.
Yeah. That does happen quite a bit.
Yeah, because actually, I don't know if you saw the guy in the blue shirt that was just walking around here. Not that people are listening can see that that guy that was working
on facial thing.
Yeah. But he was actually the one that talked to me, about that. And I said, sure. You know, I didn't know what I was getting into. But, you know,
doesn't that happen a lot, though?
With
all associations, you don't necessarily, you don't want something to go by the wayside. So you go, I'll try to help and do it. And, you know, maybe until you can find somebody else. And then 13 years later, 13. However long it is, you're still doing it, but mm-hmm. you're doing a good job. That's why they don't want you to quit. But, I think that happens a lot in our associations. You know, we want to be involved, but we don't want to see something go by the wayside.
Right. Yeah. Years ago, I was the search for excellence for agronomy. Mm-hmm. And had it for our state chair, and had a chance to see all those things, everything that y'all said. Mm-hmm. I had a chance to see, but that was the very way I was roped into that. The guy that was taking pictures a minute ago was a former state president of ours.
Okay,
he'll be recording with us later this afternoon.
Good deal.
But at that same hand, the president at the time, who was Pat Harsty, another agent at towards the end of his career now, we were good friends, and he said, "Would you mind doing this?" Sure. Yeah. I'd be glad to.
Yeah.
And that's a good way not only to keep something going, it's a really good way to get early career people in your association involved in your association.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, this is a good time to encourage those younger people to get involved in their association, whether they're going to be like a committee chair or anything. I mean, I promise you, if you say, "Hey, I want to help," they will find you a place, because there's just not – I mean, there's nobody whooping the door down, wanting to get in and help do something. So if you have the opportunity as a young agent, if you're listening to this, and you have that opportunity, I encourage you to take that opportunity.
Absolutely.
Because you will reap benefits from it, whether it be now or years later.
For sure.
Oh, yeah, I agree. And oftentimes some people know they want to help, but they don't know how to – you know, make that step in, or they don't know really how to start getting involved. And so be willing to do that, though, if that's something you want to do and you know, put the time into it that you need to get it done.
It's the future of our associations.
That's right.
When it comes right down to it, if they're going to remain viable and remain productive, folks have to get involved. And that's not just our association at the state or national level. That's every group that's out there. Folks have to get involved and be a part, be a participant.
That's for sure.
Well, to keep things going, because, I mean, it's people come and they go.
That's
right. I mean, and you got to have folks there to take the place to keep it moving on.
I think that's really a take-home message for anybody, whether you're in extension or not, is if there's things that you don't like, get involved.
Get involved.
Sure. It's the only way to be a part of it. Help be that agent of change.
Well, that's sort of how I got involved in it, too. I started my collegiate career as an English major, so I like to write. So I would submit personal columns as an extension agent, and I never won for about 3 years. And I'm like, I got to find out why I'm not winning. So I got on the communications committee. It just kind of went from there.
Behind the scenes.
That's right. Yeah. If you can't beat them, join them type thing.
There you go.
But when you get behind the scenes, you see what makes a good program.
That's right.
You see what makes a good article.
Absolutely.
Makes a good recording.
Oh, yeah. My writing's gotten better for sure. You know, I thought I was good, but you can always get better.
Sure.
I've seen that from agents all across our state and agents from other states as well. We have some really talented writers working in extension.
We really do.
We have some really talented photographers working in extension.
We certainly do.
Folks have learned and honed that craft for other reasons, but they've helped develop themselves at the same time.
No doubt. Some of these folks could definitely make more money doing other things, but they love doing extension, you know. So.
Exactly.
Yeah, because the grass is not always greener on the other side, right. Is it, David?
That's right. Yes, that's right, as we've learned from David.
That's right. That's right.
Well, extension is a calling, as David said,
yeah.
And
yeah.
It called him back just
it
the same.
It did.
Yeah,
yeah. We're glad it did, too.
That's right.
And,
that's right.
And, you know, I'd say, too, I enjoy you being over on my part of the world, too.
Yeah,
you know,
I was in a different area.
He was
there,
in a different so, area yeah. before. Both of them were, actually.
Yeah.
But now they're over to the good part. Of
so we're all in the central time zone, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That,
y'all are
yes.
in the western right. Kentucky. We're in western Florida. We have, yep. We're yep. both states with multiple time zones, which yep. gets confusing.
Yes.
Yes.
That's exactly right.
I originally grew up in a county in central Kentucky that was right on the time zone.
Yep. I'm in one of those.
Okay.
Yep.
So every radio station locally would say it's 5 o'clock in Campbellsville,
that's
4
right.
o'clock in Greensburg. You know,
yep.
they kept that on the forefront
that's
for
right.
everybody.
Yeah. Absolutely. We say our time or across the river time. So
yeah. Yeah.
We
yeah.
called it fast time or slow time.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. I, you know, on your cell phone, when it'll change back and forth, I just leave mine on central timer. You'd never know what time it was.
Well, mm-hmm. right.
It bounces yes. all over the place.
My yeah. wife has been ardent to get me to understand that she will never move back to the Eastern
that's
time.
That's right. I cannot do Eastern time.
It's hard.
It is.
I mean, awful nice watching the news at 10 o'clock. And then falling asleep.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. I know we're all going, our state fair's going on when we're recording this podcast. They're fixing
okay.
to start. And so Jay and Vicky are having to go back early, but I've got to go next week. But they're on fast time.
Okay.
And it's just, I can't get used to that. And then when you get home, you can't get used to, you know, and they're eating, you know, about 11 o'clock their time. That's 10. I said, well, I don't need to eat yet.
Yeah.
It's just 10 o'clock, you know. But, you know, Daniel, I know we chase a big rabbit down a big hole there with all that other stuff, but get back with us about this cotton.
Yeah.
You know, for our listeners that I mean, it's just something we don't ever
yeah.
hear about. So talk
yeah.
to us a little bit about the cotton that y'all raise.
Yeah, cotton's a huge industry in North Florida for sure. It doesn't go much much south of where we are. You know, as you go down the peninsula, there's not really any cotton grown. Not that it couldn't be grown. There's not a market down there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're kind of in that cotton belt that it kind of – it's mostly in the South, as you know, but it does stretch, and there's certainly cotton grown in, you know, Texas. Texas is by far the largest cotton producing state in the country, and it's mostly in West Texas out there where
mm-hmm.
it doesn't rain, which is kind of
right.
unbelievable. But
yeah.
But yeah, cotton's an interesting crop. It's similar to peanuts as far as when we plant and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's typically planted after peanuts in our area, and then harvested a little bit after peanuts.
Okay.
I said peanuts was a beautiful crop, but cotton probably truly is our most beautiful crop.
I think so.
It's our version of snow. You know, we call
yeah.
it southern snow. We don't.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, it'll get a little snow where we are, but we get cotton every year in the fall after it's defoliated, and you know, it should be thousands of acres, miles and miles of just white. You know,
yeah.
and it is a beautiful crop.
Yep, I agree.
And it's an important crop worldwide. You know, most of the clothes that folks wear are cotton, mm-hmm. and it's used all kinds of stuff. So, cotton's a huge industry.
Mm-hmm.
In our area, that's the biggest crop that we do grow in Calhoun County. It's about 15,000 acres.
Okay.
And the county just to the north of us, Jackson, is the largest cotton-producing county in the state of Florida.
Okay.
Cotton wasn't grown in the South or in Florida for a number of years. It's somewhat recently back, the last 30 years or so, because of the cotton boll weevil.
Mm-hmm.
That pest came up from Central America, made its way through Texas and along the Gulf Coast, and really decimated the industry. And that's one of the, you know, that's one of the few, one of the really major eradication efforts that USDA has done.
Right.
Allowed us
yep.
to grow cotton again. But there was a pretty long, several decades long period there that cotton wasn't really grown. We at that time, you know, we grew other things, but cotton mm-hmm. did, it went away in the South for a number of years, really.
Is there other pests that you're having that you just know you're going to have every year in cotton or peanuts for that matter?
Well, cotton's it's one of the reasons we like to grow it. It doesn't have too many pests,
mm-hmm.
really. We deal
right.
with plant bugs and stink bugs, but that's about it as far as insects go. Peanuts have some other issues. Cotton's a pretty resilient crop to disease and insects, so it's a fairly low input. Peanuts, on the other hand, man, that's a high maintenance crop as it goes to fungus. So a lot
mm-hmm.
of fungal pathogens like to get on peanuts, leaf spot. White mold, which I think you can get in soybeans,
mm-hmm.
like a stem mold.
Similar, yeah.
Yep, yeah, similar. It's the same same fungus, just does a little bit different thing. So we actually spray seven times, seven fungicide
wow.
sprays in peanut throughout the year.
Well, I would think in that area of
And we're hot and humid.
Yes, it's a lot of rain. And it's a great environment for a disease to live
typically,
and grow.
Typically, by the end of peanut season, you know, it's a battle. Can we keep enough leaves on the plant to harvest it? You know, because obviously we don't really care what's above ground at the end of the season. We just need enough there. We can grab a hold of it and dig it. You know, as long as we can keep leaves on it, and if photosynthesis does its thing, this allowed the peanuts to develop under the ground. By the end of the year, we're just trying to hold on to some leaves and leaf spot. Yeah.
So how do you harvest it? I mean, how do you get it off the ground? And
so that's peanut inverters. You have to look this up on YouTube. It's an interesting thing, but
it's pretty neat.
It's a typically there are some self-propelled inverters, but they're mostly pull behinds behind tractors, and essentially they grab a hold of the upper part of the peanut, and there'd be points underneath it that lifts them up out of the ground and basically totally inverts the plant. So after that, the leaves will be on the bottom, and the peanut part under the ground, the roots will be facing the sky. Yep.
Okay.
and it has to do that, and that facilitates air movement and allows the plant to dry out. It's a fascinating operation.
So when they come in to get the peanuts off of the plant or whatever, I mean, do they take them to be dried? I mean, what's the process after?
Yeah, so inverting? After inversion, you know, you wait a time period, however that may be, depending on your weather. Then they come in and they'll actually harvest the peanuts, take them off the vine, put them in a semi and take them to a drying area, you know, a buying point that does dry the peanuts. And in some cases, shells, if they're going to be in the shell, obviously not. But most of the peanuts that we grow in Florida are runner types. So that's going to be shelled in things like peanuts, candy bars. I mean, peanut butter, candy bars, that kind of thing. A lot of our producers have relationships with Mars and different companies like that.
Mm-hmm. Jumping back to the cotton just a second.
Sure, yeah,
talking
I love
about
cotton.
The differences between those two crops.
Sure.
Do they work good in rotation from one another to help break some of those disease cycles?
Exactly. So cotton peanuts are primary rotation. So we'll do typically 2 years of cotton, then a year of peanut.
Okay.
And so because peanut does have such disease problems that can stick around in the soil year to year, it's a legume crop. It's a natural rotation partner with cotton, which is in the hibiscus family. So it's totally different type thing. So you ever seen a hibiscus flower? Cotton flower is very similar. White and pink, small little flowers. And of course, that's where the bowls come from. It's the fruit of the cotton plant. Mm-hmm. But natural rotation partner. Depending on price, you know, we can, and if you have irrigation, you may can throw corn in there in the place of cotton. And certainly to the east of us over in the Suwannee Valley, that's their primary rotation is corn peanut. So really just depends on the part of the area you're in. They're a little sandier than us, so the corn tends to work a little better. And a lot more irrigation over in that area. We call dry land in our area.
Yeah.
So
I was going to ask you how much irrigation y'all had.
Not much. And most of the irrigated farmers that we have call themselves dry land irrigation farmers. You know, they just turn it on when they need to, right? That's kind of a irrigation of last resort. You know, it definitely can save a crop from time to time. But as I mentioned, we typically get enough rain. It's just, do we get it all at one time? And it may go 3 or 4 weeks without rain.
Sure. And at the right time.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and peanuts are definitely foreign to anybody in Kentucky. You don't have to get too far away before we have some cotton production, though.
Yeah,
you get down into West Tennessee and the Boot Hill of Missouri,
quite
a bit of cotton grown in those areas.
We've actually had cotton grown in Webster County. We had a producer over at Clay, and he just saw it, and he said, I believe we can do that here, and he did. And it was pretty cool, and it was in Clay. And, of course, every year, everybody wanted to drive by and see the cotton, and he's not doing it anymore, but he did for several years.
You know, that's one of those things that a lot of people, especially in the ag industry, know as far as what they grow and what they can grow. Often is two different things. We could grow a lot of things in our area, but we're so far from processing.
Correct.
That it really keeps that widespread production from ever taking place.
Yeah.
How far does your producers have to drive with their hauling their peanuts or cotton to the...
Yeah. That's exactly why we grow peanuts and cotton, you know, because that's the industry locally. That's the buying points. So there are peanut buying points. We have one in Calhoun County, and then there's several in Jackson County just directly to the north. So there's seldom a peanut that goes more than 40 or 50 miles, you know, which just makes it way more economical. Yeah. And cotton's the same way. There's several semi-local gens, you know, like that it can go to. That's the primary reason, honestly, that we don't grow more soybeans in the county and we grow more peanuts. The nearest soybean buying points are little over 100 miles, you know. And so
freight
just gets into that a little bit more.
Sure. Absolutely.
Even though prices have been relatively good. So we have had some more beans grown.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, for us, that's the absolute lowest input crop, typically the one the farmers try the least on. We call them poverty peas where we are, you know. They're definitely the lowest input, you know, maybe insect spray, a fungicide spray here and there. Other than that, they mostly take care of themselves. But cotton peanuts, our primary rotation.
So they're on-farm storage of any type is not something?
No, we don't do a lot of grain storage. Yeah. There are a couple farmers that will save their own peanut seed, for instance, and so there will be a little bit of that, and we do have a couple growers that grow some corn and do their own and you know, save it there, but
mm-hmm.
as far as on farm storage, very very minimal,
very
in our part of the world. Yeah
You know, it's funny, from where Jay and I live and worked in the past, there is a lot of on-farm storage.
Yep.
Where we work now, there is not very much on-farm storage.
I remember telling David, I've been in the county I'm in about a little over 2 years now, and I maybe was there 6 months. Me and David was doing something one day, and I said, you know, the biggest thing that I see here compared to where we used to work, the farmers I work with now have very little on-farm storage.
Yep.
As compared to... And a lot of it is the size of the farmers. Where David and I actually live is a pretty large row crop area.
Sure.
A lot of on-farm storage, and it's mostly used as a harvest aid.
Yeah,
it's to keep them from sitting in line at the elevator, you know.
Interesting.
They do forward price, and they do use, you know, maybe contract half their grain or whatnot, and then the other is for speculation. But it's just like adding more trucks.
Yeah, that's right.
It keeps the ability to keep that combine running rather than sitting while a truck's at the elevator.
Exactly.
Yeah. You can start earlier. And, you know, there were a lot of times that farmers started and then they'll catch a dryer.
Yeah.
You know, they've got the wet tank full and they'll have to shut down in the middle of the afternoon.
Yeah.
You know, but that's what keeps them going. You know, if you had to wait till all of it dried, I don't know if you could get it in before it got – the weather got so bad, you know, up in our area.
We have some 5,000 to 7,000 acre producers in and around, not far from where David lives, that can turn their entire corn crop around in 12 days.
Pretty
quick. A couple of those, too.
The harvest techniques have gotten very efficient, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Cotton's the same way, you know, they can, with these big modern roller pickers, that's kind of replaced a lot of what we used to do, and now it's just one person runs it, and they run those things 24 hours a day for a couple of weeks, you know. Yeah.
I didn't know if they could run at night or not. I didn't know if the moisture would come.
It depends, you know, how humid it gets at night, you know, because the lint does need to be dry. To harvest, but yeah, so as long as the conditions prevail, they'll harvest day and night till it gets done, and that is just because cotton, once it's defoliated, the bolls are open, is extremely vulnerable, you know, to wind and rain and that kind of thing, and so once those bolls open and the plants get defoliated, it's a race every year to get it off before something happens.
That's pretty interesting, and you know, I've seen a lot of cotton fields, you know, and you may explain a little bit of this after they pick the cotton, you know, what do they do with that stalk material? I mean, what is that? Is that turned under? Is that, you know, how does that work?
So cotton, we grow it as an annual, but it's a perennial. You know, in certain parts of the world, cotton can be a small tree, you know. So we just grow it and manage it for our purposes, make it easier to pick and, you know, maximize how much fruit it's going to produce. So we grow it as an annual. After it's harvested, we do have some diseases that will stick around if we don't destroy those plants. And so they're typically either pulled mechanically or shredded or mowed. Yeah, so. That's typically what happens.
I know in the Boot Hill of Missouri, way on up after the crop is harvested, I mean, even on into January, you may see some stalk fields still standing like that.
Yeah, and where we are, we obviously don't get cold enough often to kill the plant outright. Even, you know, they spray it and defoliate, it doesn't kill the plant. It'll come back from the ground. And so what we don't want to see is that cotton regrowth persisting throughout the wintertime. Because a lot of times, this last year we got cold enough to kill it, but there's an awful lot of years we don't get cold enough to kill that cotton regrowth, and it just grows right on through. And, you know, that can harbor insects and diseases into the next year. So that's why we shred those stalks. Yeah.
So what is the typical, in winter time, where you are, what is that? The temperature range, like your day and nighttime temperature?
Yeah, so I mean, like every part of the country, we get those cold fronts, and the temperatures can swing drastically during the winter time. But typically, you know, we're you know, our cold season, January, February, will be, you know, it can range, but typically a normal day would be 60s, you know, upper 50s, Occasionally we'll get a day that doesn't get above freezing, but that's one in every quite a few years. You know, we had one or two of those around Christmas last year. It got cold everywhere in the country.
Oh, yeah.
That was extreme, you know.
That was extreme.
But we can certainly have days in the 70s. I've worn shorts at Christmas. You know, it can definitely happen.
I have too, but it's, you know, not 25 degrees.
We're that's right. I was telling Vicky the other day, my brother and I like inshore fish down around Apalachicola Bay, you know, redfish, trout, snook, kind of stuff. Some of our best fishing trips have been in December and January, you know.
Absolutely.
It's a wonderful place to live in the wintertime. You know, I was looking outside and how nice it is here today. I was joking with somebody on the way up here. It's like we spent a couple months in hell and just entered the gates of heaven coming up here. So I think we're in the low 70s today here in Iowa, and back home we're in the around 98, 99 today. I'm not missing it.
I would not either.
I spent last week in Maine on vacation.
Oh, man, yeah.
Came home to almost 90 degrees and that much humidity as well, and suffered for, you know, 3 days, and then I headed up here. I told Vicky as soon as I run into her this morning, I said, boy, it's nice outside.
It is so nice. Everybody I've seen from Florida can't stop talking about the weather.
Well, last night at the welcoming dinner, there was a couple of fellas there at our table.
From Florida.
And that's exactly what they were saying is, boy, this
how
is
nice it was,
how
yeah.
nice it was.
And one
nice
guy said, you can sweat from as soon as you walk out of the house to go to your truck. By the time you get to your truck, he said, you already sweat.
I normally sweat, take my dog out to use the restroom in the morning, you know.
You know, it's hot when you do that.
Yeah, and so temperatures like we're seeing today, I think it's going to be in the mid-50s tonight here, you know, low 70s during the day. This is our, you know, late October, November, into early December weather typically, so enjoying it.
This is
fall in Florida right now.
Well, if you could move up north in the summertime,
that's what Vicky and I were saying.
Yeah, that's what we were
saying.
Move
south in the winter. That'd kind of be the perfect world, I guess.
After we strike it rich in extension, I'm gonna live in Kentucky or North Carolina, something like that, in the summer, and head back to fish in Florida in the wintertime for sure.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was just telling you about somebody that came to Webster County from Florida.
We are. Tourism is the number one industry in the state of Florida, but ag is number two, and it's all. Always been that way, and we hope it's always going to be that way, you know.
And I think there's a lot of people that don't know that agriculture is number two.
Yep.
I mean, because you know, you get people the further removed from agriculture they are, anywhere they are, you know, in the U.S. When they think of Florida, they think of oceans.
Yeah.
They think of the beach.
Yep.
And they don't think that there's a whole lot more.
Right.
Well,
the
national meeting was in West Palm Beach, Florida last year, and I mean, within just a short bus ride, you got to see a lot of agriculture that the state of Florida has to offer.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. Palm Beach County and Miami-Dade County are the two by far the most valuable ag counties in the state of Florida, and you sure wouldn't know that if you've never been to Florida. You know, you've got West Palm there, which is, you know, the nicest of nice places, beaches and all of that, you know, exclusive resorts and billionaires and all this, and 10 miles inland, it's as rural as it gets, you know. Sugar cane and rice grown as far as you can see, cattle ranches, dairies.
That honestly is my favorite part of Florida, the central part of the state. When I say central, I mean down through the middle of Florida, from north to south.
Yep.
I love the panhandle too. My wife is one of those tourists that would go live on the beach if she could. When I'm down there, I'm a livestock person by nature, and specifically a horse person.
Sure.
You know,
well, you're
outside,
in Kentucky. So.
Through Ocala and down through that part of the state, there's a lot of horses.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of livestock as you go south from there. And when we went to West Palm Beach last year, I went early and fished at Okeechobee for a couple of days before I went over. And,
absolutely.
You know, the dairies and the livestock in and around that area, you can tell it's a big part of the state.
Yeah, so the first ag industry in the state of Florida, as far as most people are aware, is cattle. You know, that was Spaniards brought those over from Europe, and that's industries flourished in Florida for hundreds of years. You know, it's by far the oldest ag industry we have. So
at one time, one of the leaders in livestock numbers east of the Mississippi River, I mean, top one or two as far, I think Kentucky may be number one in beef and feeder calf production now.
Yeah.
I think Florida was two or three.
We're way up there every year for sure. A bunch of big ranches. Of course, everybody thinks citrus. Citrus is a much smaller industry in the state as it used to be. I'm sure y'all driving through Florida, you didn't see you don't see citrus groves anymore, and the ones you see look awful. And that's primarily related to citrus greening. Our industry is about 20% of what it was at its peak about 30 years ago. So
Oh, wow. It's not, I knew it had changed, but yeah.
We're about eight. It's about, you know, it's roughly a fifth of what it used to be. Yeah. So.
There's a guy in my home county that used to manage a citrus grove and feedlot operation down there.
Yep. That's very common in South Florida, you know, citrus and cattle together was very common.
I had a good friend there in Christian County for years, Mr. Wayne Boyd. Laney Boyd's dad managed a dairy down at Okeechobee for years.
Yep. Yeah, the Okeechobee area is our big dairy producing region of the state, which you wouldn't think is really hot down there. You know, I've always wondered how they keep the milk fresh down there, but they do.
Well, if our listeners hadn't had the chance to see part of Florida away from the coast, you know, if next time you're traveling, get off on some of those rural roads and because it is beautiful. I know that we went, my husband and I went to Tampa a few years ago. There was a tractor museum that he wanted to go to, and he collects toy tractors, but there was a museum, and so we flew into Tampa and then rented a car and drove, and I forget the name of the town, but I remember thinking just not far out of Tampa, I mean, right. I was seeing cattle everywhere, and it was pretty cool because you don't think of that in Florida. I mean, you don't.
It's a cool state, that's for sure.
It is.
You know, for those folks who are going to come to Florida,
yes, sir,
they're probably going to come to the beach. But what's one thing that somebody needs to see in Florida outside of the beach or Disney?
Oh man, that's a great question. So, you know, I spent a good amount of time, like I said, at Pensacola. So if you're ever over there, I definitely recommend checking out the Blue Angels when they fly. They're based out of Pensacola. That's a great tourist attraction, you know, and a lot of folks over there will stay at the beach, take a boat out and watch the Blues fly from the beach or out in the water. And that's really cool. So if you're in Pensacola, I'd highly recommend that. If you're in Bluntstown ever, you know, come by and see us at the extension office in Calhoun County.
Hey, so, there you go.
Sounds like an invite. Yeah,
I may do that one of these days.
8 to 4 Monday to Friday, you know, we'll be there.
Somebody will be there.
I may be out in a field somewhere, but I won't be too far away. So
I think that's every ag agent.
That's right. Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, we appreciate you being here with us today. As everybody who listens knows, we like to wrap things up with a timely tip. We're in August right now. The show is actually going to air probably mid-September, early to mid-September. So a good timely tip for that time of the year, I think, is road safety. Especially in our part of Kentucky, harvest will be going on. There will be a lot of large equipment on the roads. And I just want to remind everybody to take a little time, add a little time to your traveling commute if you know you're going to be in and around some farm equipment, and kind of give those guys the road. The road's there for everybody, but they don't stop on a dime. They don't turn on a dime. And a lot of times they need a little extra space. So don't crowd them. Give them a little extra room and a little extra stopping distance. And one thing you need to think about, too, and David's brought this up before, when you're in a little passenger vehicle and you run up behind that combine, he has no way in the world that he can see you. So stay back, even following them, stay back off of them where they can use their mirrors. And if they've got a vehicle following them, you know, as a lead vehicle or an escort, in the front or the back, that helps. But on that same hand, if they don't run right up behind them, give them a little bit of leeway and stay back off of them where they can see you too.
Absolutely. They're certainly not intentionally going slow to you know, persecute you, so to speak.
Right.
They're trying
to
do their job as efficiently as they can. So they're doing the best they can, and you can help them do that.
And they're trying to keep you and them and you safe.
That's right. Yep.
Yep. Just pay attention.
Yeah.
Pay attention. I tell people that all the time. Just pay attention.
And if you meet somebody that is flagging, that is a lead vehicle for them, and they're flagging, they're letting you know there's something coming, you know, slow down and be watching.
Yeah. Well, once again, special thanks to Mr. Daniel Leonard for joining us and for this week's information. And thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters, and Florida Ag matters too. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.